Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Ghost Spider Groupies, the podcast dedicated to Gwen Stacy of Earth 65, also known as Spider-Gwen and Ghost Spider, where we review her comics, discuss news, and give our opinions about all things Gwen 65. I'm Abigail.
And I'm Pex. And today with us, we have the creative team from the Spider-Gwen Smash mini-series that we've just wrapped up reviewing on the podcast, and that's just finished releasing this past couple of months. We've got Melissa Flores.
Hello. Hi.
And we also have Anid Balam.
Hey, you guys.
Melissa, Anid, welcome to the show. We also have to mention that we're actually celebrating our 65th episode today. So we all know that 65 is a very important number to Gwen. But more importantly, you know, we thought it would be great to celebrate 65 episodes to have the both of you on.
Oh, that's nice.
Congratulations.
Yeah, congrats. That's a lot of podcasts.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like we've done 65 episodes about Spider-Gwen, but at some point we got here, so yeah.
But it means that we lasted as long as Spider-Man the Animated Series, and unlike that show, we know where MJ is. Well, kind of.
But yeah, so we've got a few questions to ask you about you guys as comic fans, as comic creators, and of course the process for making a Spider-Gwen comic book that we wanted to get into with you guys, if that's cool.
Absolutely.
Sure.
So the first thing we always like to ask is like your background into comics. Like, what are your first loves with comics? Like, what got you into comics, essentially leading up to your Marvel origin story?
I'll go first.
Yeah.
I didn't really grow up with comics as a kid. You know, I was my dad, immigrant from Jalisco, who is now a citizen. But you know, he worked very hard. Wasn't a lot of time for comics growing up, and so my first foray into comics was comic book cards, which I would collect when I went to school. They'll sell these like Marvel little comic book packs, and you could collect them and put them in a binder. That's when my first like little foray into what comics were and superheroes and all that. And then as I got older, I got really into video games. And so they had these digital deluxes editions, or these deluxe editions of these video games. And they came, the one for Injustice came with a issue one copy of the one by Tom Taylor, the issue one by Tom Taylor. And that was how I first started reading comics. And it was just that one issue. And I was like, where's the rest of it? So then I started looking, and I went into a comic book store looking for the rest of year one of Injustice. And that's kind of how I started reading. And then when I worked for Power Rangers as a development executive, we started working with Boom Studios for Power Rangers, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. And that's how I got to learn the process of how comic books are made. So what it takes to write them, and the artists, and the lettering, and the coloring, and the timetable, and all that fun stuff. So that was like a really good boot camp for me. And after I left Power Rangers, I started writing myself. And so I ended up writing Mighty Morphin Power Rangers for Boom Studios, which I'm still doing now, as well as The Dead Lucky for Image. And those two got the attention of an amazing editor named Sarah Bronsted, who gave me a shot in Women of Marvel. And I was super excited about it because I got to write one of my all-time favorite Marvel characters, America Chavez, and Kate Bishop. And then from there, I got to write Echo, and that led to Spider-Gwen with Ellie and MR.
That's awesome. I've heard that you like to talk about Power Rangers a lot.
I don't know if I like to talk about Power Rangers. It just happens to be like a big part of my life, so it just naturally comes up a lot.
Well, I'm curious, what does a development executive on Power Rangers do? Are you working on the television, on the toys,
or everything? My official title was I had like a three or four different titles, but it was by the end of it I was a director of Power Rangers storytelling. But essentially anything with a story, I was basically the lore master, the brand master. Like there is now 30 seasons of Power Rangers, and that's a lot of different teams of Power Rangers. And so that's a lot of mythos and a lot of lore. And so my job as a development executive is, whether it's a video game, a book, a TV series, a feature film, anything, a live tour, my job was to make sure that the story was the best Power Ranger story it could be. and to work with those different departments from a brand perspective and a franchise perspective and development perspective to make sure that the story was told in the way that would be in line with what we needed it to be.
Does that make sense? Because like reading this comic felt like you had gone back and you'd consumed a lot of Spider-Gwen and you'd really brought that.
Oh yeah, yeah. I take that very seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really, you know, which is actually we really appreciate as fans is when a writer has read the previous canon. That really came through, that did.
By the way, Enid is also working while he does this, so if you're hearing the little crackles, that's what's happening, and it's fascinating to watch. But
it's a lot of authenticity.
All right, Enid, what about you? First comic loves that your origin story that evolves into your Marvel origin story.
Well, I was born in a very rural area in Mexico. Actually, there wasn't even a comic book store or like a book to reach out where I can understand what comics were. But the spiritual part of it, it's that when I was about 5 or 6 years old, I was already telling my mom and my dad that I wanted to do something with books, but I didn't know what about them. What was it? So sort of like knowing it all along. And I started my life doing, like, staying here with people and traveling to my imaginary worlds and drawing at the same time. So I was like an outcast from the beginning, from day one. So you would find me, primary school, always at detention because I was drawing in stories and stuff. So I got into so much trouble to trying to explain to the world what I wanted to do. And it was somewhat hurtful, but a journey indeed to discover what I was to do. And eventually I ended up, while I was finishing my master's on art production, I was hired by Delcourt, which is a French publisher house, as a colorist. I started my career as a colorist, and I worked on a French comic book, which are 46 pages and like super giant books. After that, I worked with Titan Comics. I was doing a graphic novel for B. Schwab, Victoria Schwab, called Extraordinary. And as I was illustrating that, I was reached by Marvel to engage in a miniseries of a Mexican-American character named Reptil. It's a young guy who can turn into dinosaurs. So it was really fun, and at that moment I got placed in front of the question, do you want to do this for real? Because I was doing two books simultaneously, and it's something very difficult because you have to be involved in both stories with corrections and with everything that goes on doing a comic book behind the scenes. So I was turning 42 pages per month, and that was my life for a year and a half. So I get pretty sick as soon as I reach 1 year working like that. So I ended up quitting one job, fulfilling my contract, and staying with Marvel. So far, I've been working 4 years with them in that incredible stories. And recently, our most recent miniseries was Spider-Gwen. I shared the creative table. And I was honored to be seated along Melissa and Elisabetta D'Amico, who is the Italian inker, as well as Fer Cifuentes from Mexico, doing the colors. So it was such a pleasure, such a pleasure, and such a joy to work along them.
Yeah, it really was. Like this team was absolutely outstanding. Just like the creative process was just so delightful at every turn because, you know, usually I give a script and then, you know, I try to, I don't know, Enid can tell you whether I was successful or not. Like I try to give a little bit of description, but not too much because I want them to feel like they have enough freedom to do what they want to do. But every page was always just astounding. And Enid, I owe you an email because I still want those pencils from you. I've just been very busy. But they're just amazing. And then to see the inks come out from Elisabetta and those colors, like they were just so saturated and beautiful. Like it was just, it's such an amazing process. Like my dream was always to write Spider-Gwen, but to have it be done with this team was particularly fulfilling and amazing.
That's awesome.
So do you find it's easier as a penciler as opposed to having to do the inks as well? Or is it harder having to work with more people?
You know what I found harder, if I can be really honest, balancing life, because I work from the morning until 8, 9, 10 p.m., but life happens, and there's always something to fix, something to address, something to I don't know, I'm a human being. I need time with my couple, with my wife, with my dog, with my cat. I like to do other things. So that would be my answer, if I can be honest, because doing the pencils, doing the inks, doing the colors, I've done it all, and I enjoy every bit of it. But I do try to focus myself into try to aspire to a well state of mind during the process, so I can enjoy it. Because I find a lot of people in comics that struggle because there's always the time trying to, like, walking just behind you. You have to turn in the work, but there's also life happening. There's accidental things and a lot of things that happen. So my main goal is to try to stay focused, but trying to enjoy the short process instead of suffering, trying to enjoy it as much as I can. So I really don't mind the technical issue, but rather trying to the good state of mind, the positive state of mind, how to answer an email, how to be compromised with the work, to try to develop the story as close as I can to the directions of the writer. So that would be my answer.
Thank you. That's a very in-depth answer about things. And have you found your health has improved since you've gone sort of exclusive with Marvel?
I'm not exclusive with Marvel.
I mean,
I'm looking forward to it. So,
well, I mean, I'm praying for you. I mean, but
thank you. Yes, my health has improved a lot. But as I was telling you, I have found and a spiritual growth into the work. So I do not get tired, for example, as much as I was at the beginning. But I try to stay balanced in a sense that I became a vegetarian. I no longer drink, for example. I no longer stay up late, only for TV series and for friends, for pizza nights and games. So I've become a better person. That's what I'm trying to get at. And instead of taking this as a downhill or something that would take something away from you, I'm trying to put my soul into it, and not in a religious way, but actually in a conscious-based manner, to try to do the things that I'm doing awaken and grateful to the people I'm having the pleasure and the delight to work with.
Self-care is the key.
Yeah, that's I'm glad to hear it. That is, yeah, it's tough work. It's tough work.
So as we jump into when the book was first conceived, how did the plot come about? Melissa, we'll start with you.
I had worked with Ellie and Amar on the Echo miniseries for Marvel Unlimited for Infinity Voices. And they came back and said, hey, we're going to be doing a Spider-Gwen series and we want it to take place in Earth 65. Like, what do you got? And so I had just recently watched Into the Spider-Verse. And one of the things that always just really struck me about that brilliant, brilliant film is the way they use music and the way they really allowed Gwen to bury herself in her drums and to hash out all that frustration. And I come from a musical background. I haven't done it in very, very long time, and in a way to kind of mourn it because I miss my voice. But I was like, that might be the way in. And I also like really just wanted, if we're going to stay in Earth 65, I just felt like she'd been in all these different places. I had read everything before her, which are all great. They're fantastic. But like we don't develop, there's not a lot of development in what's happening to her in actually with her friends, with the Mary Janes, with the world around her. The Sue Storm was stuff was still undeveloped a little bit. And so I was like, what can I do to really help her feel more at home in Earth 65 and feel like she has a home in Earth 65? Because I don't think she has that. She had that before. She spent so much time out of it that coming back just felt very awkward to her, in my opinion. And so that's when I came up with the tour aspect. It was 4 issues that were given to me. I was like, okay, each city is a tour stop. And they were also encouraging me to come up with different iterations of Marvel characters that could live in Earth 65. And originally, it was another character that I really wanted to put in. But Dazzler came up, and it was something that I fell in love with very quickly. So it was like, okay, Dazzler and Gwen team up with some Mary Janes on the side. That sounds exactly like what I want to do.
Are you allowed to say which character was intended?
I mean, I don't know. I don't think it's ever going to happen. But I also don't want anybody to get mad at me. So I was kind of picturing a Thor, like Rock of Ages, kind of like rock god. That's kind of where I was going.
So cool.
But we ended up like, I like kind of just like the long hair, like leather, like that's kind of what I wanted. But Dazzler was no easy, like it wasn't like Dazzler was my second choice. Like I freaking love Dazzler. They're like, what about Dazzler? I was like, yes, let's do it. Dazzler's amazing. So that was great.
Yeah. And Dazzler was already established in Earth 65. Well, she was just like, her name was just in the background during right. the Jason Latour run. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it does make sense to bring Dazzler to the forefront, and plus, you know, the X-Men are now making a resurgence.
Yep. And so, yeah, so we got to like really play with the mutant stuff, which is fun.
Yeah. Well, honestly, it was very, very cool to see all of that, because it hasn't been explored very much in sort of Earth 65 mutants and that. And Dazzler makes sense, I think, and it's just, you know, it maps right onto all that music stuff that you're talking about. Yeah. I thought I haven't seen Thor play guitar yet, as cool as that might be.
Mm-hmm. Not unless if you count his rocker look in Love and Thunder, but I think that's as close to punk rock as you'll get.
I'm trying to forget that film.
But I understand you have a personal connection to each of these 4 cities that you chose, right?
Yeah. I never like to write out of turn if I don't know what I'm writing about, and especially when it comes to cities. And so obviously I grew up in Los Angeles. Las Vegas is very near here, and I had family in Las Vegas, so I grew up there too. And Chicago I was born in, and New York is obviously New York. Like, who hasn't been to New York? So if you live in, at least if you live in LA, like it's you know, and you're fortunate, you go to New York a lot. So I've been to New York quite a bit, and I love New York. It's so different than LA. So and we play with that a little bit in the series, where you actually see Gwen have an issue with not being able to swing, because LA is so spread out and there's only like one place, or like the places where she can actually swing like she can in New York are like clustered into little bits and pieces. So she had a little bit of a hard time, but thankfully Dazzler was there with her hard light to help her.
Because the thing is, Anid, have you been to either Chicago or New York before?
I've been to New York Comic Con, and I will be in I will attend C2E2 for the first time next month. So yeah.
I think this is still going to play. Can each of you settle once and for all who's got the better pizza, Chicago or New York?
Oh, man. I'm not from either place. Like, I mean, I came to LA when I was 2. So I feel like I'm just putting myself for a world of hurt. Personally, I prefer New York pizza, because deep dish is not my jam. But that doesn't mean it's any better. It's just so different. It's hard to compare.
I think deep dish is more of a casserole, if you ask me.
I mean, I have it every time I go, but New York pizza is a lot easier to get here too. So that's probably why I'm more partial.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot online about how like places like LA aren't very walkable, but it was really funny seeing like how you sort of you can't even swing in LA. It was a really good little bit that, and then you have Dazzler make the light platforms. It was really creative use of those characters and the location. So it all came together quite nicely. It was
That was all up to Enid. Like, I had no idea how like even to like give him the reference for how to make it work. Cause like, I know I've been there. I know exactly what I'm talking about, but like looking through and trying to find images, and be like, okay, so here's where the what used to be the Staples Center is. And here it's the Tony Stark Center, I think what we call it. And here it's like proximity to downtown. And like, how do I make sure that he knows exactly what that looks like? It was like, I hope I helped enough.
That's really cool.
Oh, I think we should get to the part where you eventually got paired with each other. Like, how did that?
Well, it's always if I may jump in, it's always an adventure because you never know who you're gonna work with. That's the thing. I mean, I do not get to ask who I'm going to work with, but I always welcome everyone who wants to work with me and as I get assigned to, because you'll get to know a lot of people. And curious enough, I have been so fortunate to always become friends or acquaintance in good terms to the writers I have worked with. I don't know why, but I think it's so awesome, and I feel privileged to always like befriend them in Facebook or Instagram and follow their life. It's super nice to get to know new friends, and as well you get to know them professionally, so you get to see something that it's behind or enclosed that is a creativity, a very unique voice that maybe people don't get to see as I do when I read the scripts. For example, I never read the last half of the script. I always read 10 pages. And as I finish drawing them, the first 10 layouts, I jump into the other 10, but without reading them. I just discover every page as I draw them because I like to feel engaged and excited. So I do not want to spoil what I'm going to draw. But I often try to do some sort of, you might know it as maybe talking about references. Melissa sent me a lot of some pictures of what she wanted to be illustrated. But as well, I try to feel like this... You might call it or know it as some sort of remote viewing, something that I try to think and do not overthink it, but just try to feel what the other person is writing and try to be confident that whatever I draw is somewhat connected to that other person because of past time. I don't know if I'm being too whimsical or mysterious here, but what I do mean is that I don't think when you get to know people is something like a coincidence. I do believe, for example, I live in LA, so the places I know those places that Melissa was describing. So I don't know how to say it. It's a special connection, but you cannot realize it if you do not see it with time. I don't know, maybe I walked when I was a kid, when I was in sixth grade, I walked up a street and Melissa was walking the other street. So I don't know how this happened, but it is very common. You do not work in these things randomly. I do believe there is some sort of invisible string that connect people. So I try to feel it and I try to express it with the work. So maybe that's the connection I'm realizing as I move forward with work.
Wow.
Yeah, I always feel like it's also harder for artists because they're getting something already and they're having to interpret it. Like me, it's what's in my head that I get to that I have to write down. And so I'm always very conscious of how I write things, especially because I work with a lot of international artists as well. And so I don't want to give them like a script as if I would give them a novel. Like I want to try and give like opportunities. But I also know that I cannot write the Marvel method. Like I can't. I come from TV. I like need to know what the panels like. I need to just now. Like I've had plenty of instances, and I welcome them where the artist is like, "Okay, you said five panels, but I think you can do this in four, or I think you can do this in six," and that's fine. That's perfect. That's exactly what we need. And then I just go back to the lettering draft and I change everything. Or like what I tend to do more is cut dialogue. So that the art can, if it's like a beautiful page, I don't want to just cover it up with a bunch of dialogue bubbles. So I'll try to cut dialogue so that the art can sing a little more. And so really, like, I admire what the challenge the artists have, because there's a level of trust there. You know, I always have to trust that the artists that are assigned onto the book with me, one, like me, but two, are on board with the story I'm telling. And thankfully, I just got so lucky with Anit and Elisabetta, and hopefully the scripts connected with them. And to Anit's point, like every time I would get pencils, they were always a beautiful surprise, because there's the way I see things in my head, but that's the lovely surprise of working with an artist and having that trust, is that it's never what I envision it. It's always better and it's always different. And that's the real magic of comic books. I think you're not doing it by yourself.
So something related to that. So Melissa, did you have a say in character design when sending your notes to Anit?
I mean, I would see them, but really, truly, I was very hands-off on the notes, specifically. And if I have a creator-owned series, I'm a little more in-depth about it. But when it comes to Marvel, you know, I mean, Ellie and Omar are such amazing editors, and I don't want to... I'm very much of the opinion that we don't need too many chefs in the kitchen, unless there's something that I feel like it's like, oh, no, this is actually not what... This is going to mess with the intention of the scene. That's when I will give a note. But usually, I mean, you saw these designs. They're beautiful. They're gorgeous. They were exactly what like they needed to be. Like, I had very little need to say or do anything. Usually it was just a matter of like, this is beautiful. And I felt like I wasn't contributing at all. But I didn't need to. Like, they were just... Everybody was just firing on all cylinders. And every time I got an email, I was just like, oh my God. So what could I say? Like, I didn't want to add my voice just to add it. I feel like, you know, they were doing their thing and they're masters at it already. Like, what's the writer going to say? Like, they're already doing amazing work.
Because I read somewhere that you actually did have a say when during the giant size issue, we'll get to that a lot later, in designing Orlando Octavius.
Yes, him I did, because he's a completely original character. And so I had an idea in mind. But again, it was a description, just like I gave Anit a description of what Dazzler would look like. And I think I said it was like a mix of Britney Spears and Lady Gaga or something. And so for Orlando with Alba, it was the same thing. It was just like, you know, this is a handsome kid with shiny shoes and a really expensive trench coat and glasses, Latino. Then came the design. And there was, once I saw the design, I didn't really tweak it. I didn't do anything. I just was like, this is beautiful. I don't know. I'm just that person. I think they're so good at what they do. How can I tell them that it's not, you know, they're amazing. And usually for me, I see it very much as a collaborative process. Like, it's their characters as much as it's mine. So I would never dream to tell them, well, actually his horn ribs should be green and not black. Like, they're already doing me the favor of doing what I asked them to do. Like, they need the liberty to do their thing too, because this is their character too. This is a two-part process. There's an artist and a writer, and we work together. It's both of our books, not just mine.
Mm-hmm. That's really awesome.
So when the book was first announced, this was actually supposed to be called Spider-Gwen on Tour, and then it got retitled to Smash.
Yes.
What was the
why? because they told me. No, truly, because the Hulk was going to show up and they wanted to capitalize on it. So I understood it. It made sense. But it was, if you didn't know the Hulk was coming, it was a little bit of a throw. I know that people were just like, why? And then when the Hulk showed up, it's like, oh, because he smashes. Okay. That was why.
Yeah. I pretty much called it. Remember that convo that we had during NYCC? I made that guess.
Yeah. Licensed books, you know, you're not the only person, you're not the only voice in the room, right? Like, you're a team player. You're lucky to be on the works that you're given. These aren't your characters. This isn't your stories, really. Like, you're lending your voice. But the best perspective I always have with these licensed characters, and I worked for Power Rangers for 10 years. I've done licensed books. I do licensed books now. Own the story the best way you can is what I always think. And but the characters aren't yours. You know, the story at the end of the day belongs to Marvel. So you're going to do the best job you can it's not your sandbox. You just get to play in it. So if they decide they want the sandbox to be a different shape or a different color, that's their prerogative. They have 1,000 different reasons for why they want it to happen. And it's not really up. Like, sometimes they'll tell you why and sometimes they won't. But that doesn't mean there's not a reason behind it. You just have to trust that there's a reason for what they're doing. And, you know, as a writer, you're not told everything all the time, but you trust that there's a reason why they're giving those notes. Because I've been on the other end. I was a development executive and I've had to give those notes to the writers where I'm just like, this isn't going to make sense. This is going to sound really silly, but we have to make this change. And I wasn't at liberty to explain why. And at times I didn't agree with the note, but I had to give it. And so it's one of those things where I'm very understanding of that process and very willing to work with it. And so if they want it to be smash, there's a reason and I'm down. Let's do it.
Sure enough.
But it was really interesting how you decided to make Banner the villain.
Yeah, that was fun. It was actually, Ellie or Amar's idea, honestly. Like, they were just like, hey, because we were talking about bringing in Hulk. And they're like, what if, and I wanted Banner to be a stalker because I had actually been stalked pretty recently. And so it was very heavy on my mind. But the twist of, you know, what if Hulk's the good guy? That was, I think Ellie added that. She's like, what if Hulk's the good guy and Banner's the bad guy? And I'm like, that's perfect. That's great. But I'm curious what Anid thought about like all of this, because the artists never tell me what they think of the stories, probably for good reason, because my little ego would probably be hurt. But like, I'm curious what you thought of all of this, because you've been working for Marvel for a bit.
Well, I really loved how you expressed the collaboration aspect of it. So I often call it the philosophy of togetherness, because it's something really, how do you say this? Something that disappears, like ephemeral, because it stays for a while. There's a contact with a lot of males, daily males, where you stay in contact with people, but eventually they will disappear. They will go away and only like the book will be the remembrance of something that happened. So I would really enjoy the story, and I wouldn't contradict or get in conflict with how it should go. I'm thinking myself as a part of something, and I am like doing it the best I can instead of getting entangled with the story. I really loved it because there was so much space to roam in the pages. There wasn't constrictions or headaches, so it had a flow of its own. I felt it like, for example, when you go in a date and you try to force things, you try to be like this other person that you are not, and things are not working naturally. I think it's the same with this type of books, because as Melissa pretty wisely acknowledged, they are not ours. They are just simply ours for a little time, and we best enjoy as much as we can. And we do not get the final word to the story. We might propose something, but at the end, Marvel is gonna do to hammer down and deliberate or have the final word into it. So as much as we want something, we would want something with the story, our voices would be just like heard and took seriously, but maybe they have some plans with the characters. And they really know their how to manage the characters. For example, I'm going to give you one brief moment where I drew a character, a teenage character, female character, and I was drawing her making a jump, like jumping a fence or jumping. So I didn't notice that I was putting one leg too much up her waist. And the editor, pretty knowledgeable about their market, told me about it. She said, oh, you know what? I would love if you could lower the leg and move it like that, so the waist would not be like a crotch scene, but instead it will be like this. Because they know that these books will get to libraries and to a section, and maybe if a parent is going through the pages really quickly, the book is going to sell to certain audiences. So we as artists, we are not, me as an artist, I'm not concerned of that, because I'm trying to figure out how to place the characters and make them act. But they, as editors, know a lot of things, a lot of informations that I do not have of a market. So trust is really wonderful, and you exercise it even more, in my opinion, even more than with friends sometimes. So it's something really strong. It's a really strong bond.
Yeah, the editors, I don't think, get enough credit. Ellie Pyle and Amar Daniel are outstanding. They work really hard. They're on a lot of books. And the kind of care and attention that they give to the writers and the artists, it cannot be overstated. Editors are the unsung heroes of the comic book world because they don't get the love and appreciation that I feel like they should. They're the ones that keep these books coming. They're the ones that manage all the deadlines. They're the ones that make sure that we don't embarrass ourselves. And they are utterly fantastic. And I'm so grateful to both of them.
It's really cool.
They're also pretty important with maintaining continuity, right?
Yeah, they absolutely are. Absolutely. And it's hard with Marvel. Like Marvel, it's not like they give you a book that's like, here's everything that's ever happened to Gwen. Like you're kind of on your own with that. But it's on you to make the research and make sure that you are doing all that. But like they will, like if you'll ask them a question, they'll definitely get you the answer.
Because we were so happy when you addressed what Tim Seeley and Emily Kim didn't. Sue Storm and the Carnage symbiote inside Mary Jane.
I think on that point, I think we should say this is the first book in 3 years that has acknowledged sort of where Spider-Gwen's old ongoings left off in a really meaningful way, and really tried to sort of dig into some of those sort of unfinished plot threads and her return to 616. And it was a breath of fresh air, I will say.
Yeah, and we now know that the reason why Gwen hasn't had any trouble was because Natasha was able to make Sue Storm go away.
I love Natasha in 65. I hope we see her again. She's just so much fun.
Going into like those the older stories, was looking at sort of you've mentioned Gwen's bandmates and her return 65, sorry, was sort of your main sort of focus. But what was there other stories that you looked at that intrigued you that you obviously didn't get time to look into at all, or what really sort of stood out to you going through the sort of past few years of Spider-Gwen comics?
Yeah, I mean, I would have loved to do more with the Mary Jane specifically. I feel like Glory and Betty are really underdeveloped. I would have loved to do more with them. There just wasn't the page count for it. But, you know, I mean, Glory specifically, I feel like has a lot that, like, I could do a whole one shot on Glory and her complicated feelings about the thing that's going on with Mary Jane. And honestly, she doesn't dump MJ after all of this. I will lose respect for her. I'm kidding. But, I just think there's a lot of things, and like we haven't really addressed how jail affected MJ or affected Gwen. There's a lot of things that I feel like there's a lot of stories left in Era 65 that I think people could pick on. When I pick up a run like this, like I joined Mighty Morphin Power Rangers after issue 100, or you know, when I do Spider-Gwen that has so many writers before me, the one thing I don't want to do is invalidate anything anybody has ever done before. What I look for instead is opportunities to pick up what they did, and either, you know, like again, if I see an open little story, if I can insert something that helps nudge it along, like the Sue Storm line, I'm going to do that. Even though the story isn't about Sue Storm, if I could put that in that little line that's going to help the fans feel a little more validated for knowing that stuff, all the better. But my main focus, when I know that I'm just like one of many writers are going to be taking on these characters, is providing opportunities for future writers to eventually come back to. So I want to tell my own complete story, but I want to be able to do it in a way that if somebody comes back and reads Spider-Gwen Smash and it's like, oh, hey, that didn't really get like picked up on again, maybe I can work with that. That's what I want to do. That's what I do when I read these original stories. When I look back at these books, I look for those opportunities. So that's how the Carnage thing came about. I remember having the conversation with, it wasn't actually initially going to be part of the series, but I remember rereading it and I was like, oh, right. The Carnage symbiote is still in MJ and nobody's done anything with that. That's a lot of rage in this character. And right now, specifically, we're dealing with Gwen bonding to somebody else that isn't MJ on the tour that MJ really wanted to use to make them bond. Like, wouldn't that be a little anger-inducing, and like, wouldn't that like maybe poke at the symbiote? And so I ended up actually texting Ellie and being like, hey, where are we on this? What's going on? And so we had a little bit of a conversation, and so we kind of modified a little bit of the plot so that the Carnage symbiote could be the big like finale part of it. And that was really fun for me because it was really nice to be able to bring that back. And then also it provided a nice segue into the giant size one shot where we can give her a place to go and do something definitive. Like, you know, the Mary Janes have at the moment, they're no more because MJ has gone. And so that felt like a really significant bittersweet turn of events, but I felt necessary because up until this point, they've kind of been treading water. It's always the same story. Like, Gwen, you're never around. Oh no, we don't like you, but we do. Oh, you know, like I wanted some sort of forward movement, if that makes sense.
That does.
Yeah. And now MJ's a very different kind of,
look at that.
Oh, I want that page.
And he's showing like an amazing art. Ugh.
We loved this page. This is like our favorite page from the book. It was so.
Have you sold that yet? Okay, hold that one for me. It's gonna make me so broke, but I don't care.
Not if I get it first.
I think you have to fight Abigail. I think the big thing that people are gonna look back on this mini series sort of going forward is probably going to be the confirmation that Mary Jane has feelings for Gwen, and that there is tension in that friendship, in that relationship there, that was a sort of heavy thing to have in there. How did you go about sort of thinking through that sort of decision and that character dynamic?
Well, it's one of those things where you have to manage fan expectations as opposed to what the actual story says. And so I kind of was of that moment where I'm just like, it feels like it's a given in the Gwen community that MJ has feelings for Gwen, but it's never been explicitly stated. And I feel like if there's a time to say it, I feel like it's now, and just make it a thing so that we're stopping the bait of it and like at least acknowledging and putting it out there. Right. Either that or it goes away completely. One of the two, but like we have to at least acknowledge that this is a thing, not just for Gwen's sake, but for MJ and for Glory. Cause I feel like, again, truly, I do think Glory deserves better than what she is kind of have to deal with, which is a girlfriend that is in love with somebody else. And so, so it was, again, one of those things where I had to have a conversation with Ellie and with Marvel and say, can I do this? And so, it is not my book. It is not my characters. There's conversations that go up and down the ladder, and there's a little bit of massaging that goes back and forth. But I'm just so grateful and thankful that they allowed me to at least speak those out and give that confirmation to the fans. Cause I feel like even if I'm not able to give like a full confirmation of a relationship, or at least, you know, we were careful with the wording and all of that, at least it felt like there was something I could give to the fans that had been waiting for this long for at least something, some sort of confirmation that, hey, no, this is actually a thing. She has feelings for Gwen. Yeah. Whether or not Gwen feels the same, that's for another writer. Like, I can tell you what my headcanon about the whole thing is. But at the very least, it gave something for MJ to really hold on to as a character, and a motivation for her to expel all this rage as the Carnage symbiote.
Based off of that, what do you think makes MJ a different kind of Carnage than Cletus Kasady? Well, other than the serial killing stuff.
Yeah, that she's not a psycho. I think MJ has never had to put herself in Gwen's shoes, really. I think this version of Earth 65 MJ is intrinsically a little bit of a selfish person, not a bad person, a little bit selfish, because of her feelings for Gwen and because of her aspirations for the band. I think she is kind of at a little bit of a tunnel block in terms of how the trauma of what Gwen has gone through has really affected her. And you guys could say I'm completely wrong because you guys like probably know way more about Spider-Gwen than I do. But I feel like she genuinely does. But the one piece that she has that is heroic and beautiful is her love for her friends. And I think that is what allows her to maintain control of the symbiote and to want to work with it. because I think if MJ was a bad person, and I don't think she is, it would have been very easy for the symbiote to take control. And the fact that she was fighting it proves that she genuinely is. I mean, this is MJ. Like, regardless what universe it is, you know, whether she's a villain or she's not, MJ is always going to be searching for her own identity. And this, I feel like, is a really cool turning point for her in terms of if they ever do come back together, and if they ever do are able to have that conversation, I think Gwen and MJ are going to be a much better place to have it, because there's going to be a lot more of understanding of where each other, the others, are coming from.
Thank you. That was a really nice answer. But as you said, like, Mary Jane kind of gets to have her say and say I love you and sort of at the end of the book and everything, but sort of Gwen's feelings are unconfirmed. They're sort of left to the decision of the future sort of person who picks up this storyline. But what is the sort of Melissa Flores pitch for Spider-Gwen Smash 2, or a follow-up sort of arc for this? You know, where do you see taking these characters, and sort of where were you angling personally?
I think I was really clear. I wanted a Sinister Six to come to Smash. I wanted the Sinister Six. I think so much of the Spider-Gwen runs have been her being super isolated on Earth 65. And so I wanted to give her a support system. And so now, like you saw at the end of the one shot, you saw she has her own rogues gallery of villains. Like, I think I remember reading, I don't remember which book it was, where she was talking about her villains in Earth 65. They tend to be second rate. And that is, that's a prime opportunity, I think, for a good villain to come in and be, and take over, because there's not a lot of heroes on 65.
Yeah.
And yeah. So you're kind of are left in a really interesting place where you have Orlando, who's a young guy who's got a lot of passion and a lot of vision, and he's got money and he's got connections. And now so does Gwen. Gwen has Natasha now. She's got Dazzler. She's got a bunch of different people that she can now come to and become a team if she needs them to be. And if I were going to do for a Smash 2, that would have been her thing. Like, you know, yeah. Gwen and her allies versus the Sinister Six. I think that would have been really fun, and really like see Earth 65 explode in terms of superheroes and villains, and have her kind of have to deal with that in a way that she hasn't had to before.
Yeah, I actually, for the giant size, I got the Dave Bardem Deadly Foes variant. And yeah, I can see the point in how, like, with her rogues gallery, there's not quite a lot to choose from.
Yeah.
I like them. I'm just gonna throw it. I like them. They're a nice little rogues gallery. They're not much, but they're nice. They're a fun bunch.
We put one more in there, I think, in the giant size at the end. Yeah. I think there was a Sandman that was a military guy.
I thought that was Thunderbolt Ross.
Well, now you know. It's meant to be I'm losing his name. I'm sorry. It's late. I'm tired.
But Flint Marko?
Yeah, it's meant to be the Sandman.
He's got sand hands. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't. He does have sand hands, yeah.
Okay. I just lost my train of thought.
I'm just looking at the time. Do you have any
like favorite parts?
What's your favorite parts? Yeah.
Well, let's let Enid answer first, because I feel like I've been dominating the conversation lately.
No, not at all. I'm enjoying it a lot. Well, actually, do you mean my favorite part of the whole series?
Yeah. What was your favorite part to draw, read?
Yeah, I don't have the page here, but there's a scene where Glory and Betty are hugging or supporting.
Wait, in the break room, right? When they lost MJ?
No, they lost. They lost MJ and lost
Dazzler.
Dazzler. So yeah, that's a really nice moment. I really love those heartwarming scenes. For example, this one at the end of the book, when MJ are confronted, some light in between them, because it talks about ourselves, the love drama and the love tension, the friendship in between is something that we will have experimented in our lives. So it's something that calls to us, appeals to us, in a sense that we have suffered the same thing. I don't know about you, but I have had my first share of troubles in love. So yes, it's something that speaks to ourselves. And as much as I love drawing action, I was really mesmerized about this love triangle. So I would really love to see it develop further. I would accept the consequences, because sometimes when I draw, for example, transgender characters or gay characters, I receive awful messaging to my Instagram account, personal hateful messages. So I would really love to receive more hateful messages, because I would know that I'm changing the world, and I'm drawing the things that make this world a beautiful place. So yeah, I love to even go further along with those characters' love and feelings about each other. I really love to draw that.
What about your favorite page to pencil?
Well, in book three, there's this moment where Wen gets out into the open in between buildings, but there's not much in Las Vegas, I believe they are, or in, I don't know, Melissa can tell me.
The Sphere?
Can you tell me where they are?
Yeah, that's in Vegas.
Las Vegas? Mm-hmm. Well, there's not much buildings around it, so she can't swing herself to another building. So Dazzler creates these beautiful rings when she can swing. So there's like a couple of images there that stuck to my mind where she's jumping and swinging into the building. So that's like the spider sense, a spider soul of the character. So I would really love that. And there's a really tiny panel where she gets defeated by this new Hulk. She's unconscious and she's like lifting herself up and pulling rubble off herself, and that's really lovely. But I have another panel that I loved where she's how do you say it? She's lifting or holding Dazzler, just at the end of the book. She gets thrown away by Carnage, and from the shadows, this super strong Wen emerges, carrying Dazzler on her arms, and those type of things are really powerful. And
yeah,
tend to stay in your imaginary. I kept thinking about it a lot of days. So yeah, there was a bunch. It was a lot of fun to draw.
Before I forget, yeah, I want to mention, I love how you went classic Mark Bagley with MJ Carnage.
Oh, thank you. I didn't have a lot of references. I really know so few about comics, really. I'm getting to know a lot. I come from another planet entirely, so I'm trying to stay informed, but trusting in what I am bringing to the team work I'm doing. So instead of filling myself with a lot of references from the history of comic books, I'm trying like a blank page and trying to start over. So you might see references, but I've seen so few of artist Bagley. I know his work, but I do not know all the references. It's something I do, but I don't have the information. I'm sorry that I'm not so, I don't have a lot of knowledge into comic book history. I'm trying to make a really non-violent Carnage. I don't know how to say it. It's a psycho. It's a really difficult character to draw for me, because I'm a softie. I love tenderness and lovable characters instead of, for example, I get, I feel really weird when people tell me, "Hey, you're killing it." What am I killing? I feel like I'm building it right alongside a lot of people. So yeah, I do not engage into a lot of violence. So I enjoy drawing Carnage, but I was away. I wasn't thinking about how I was gonna draw her, because I'm trying to bring what I have honestly, and I think it's important to be confident that we are here for a purpose.
Oh, and I love the detail about how, in issue two, you changed Gwen's chucks to resemble real chucks.
The high tops.
Mm-hmm. Took me three issues to do it. Yeah, it started like a ballerina shoes, and then as we talked, I took your comments into consideration. So it was really fun to make a mirror with the movies.
Yeah.
So I think you've mentioned this before, but by the time you got the giant size, were you aware that they were going to ship her to 616?
No. I found out after the giants, after I started breaking the giant size. And so, I found out. When did I find out? I found out at New York Comic Con, I think. Or was it LA Comic? I don't remember. I found out after, though. So,
pretty much the same time we did.
Yeah, basically. And honestly, it's fine. Like, I don't like I've seen some comments where people are like, you know, Flores was screwed. Like, I don't want people to go with that narrative. Like, again, these aren't our characters. This, you know, it's up to Marvel, like, to decide what they want to do with the characters. Like, I am happy. One, Stephanie Phillips is amazing and she's going to kill her run and she's going to be or not kill it. What's the softer way of saying that? But we're no longer
using that term now.
I think it's positive still.
Yeah, she's a fantastic writer, and I'm super excited to see what she's going to do with a 616 ongoing with Gwen. But I also am really hopeful that people are going to want to see Gwen back at 65. We've left enough track there that writers and fans are going to be like, hey, what about the Sinister Six? Like, what's happening? What happened to Gwen and to MJ? Like, I want them to want to go back. And so I'm hoping that that's going to be the case, but there is absolutely no like, oh my God, like, it was a surprise for me, but it doesn't mean that it was something that I'm just like, I'm bitter or upset about. Like, again, I'm just happy that I got to write the character. I am so grateful and thankful to the amazing editors that thought of me for this miniseries. And I want to work for Marvel again. Like, it's like always a lovely experience to work with these people. And I cannot say enough good things about every person at Marvel, from the artists, the colorists, the editors, et cetera. So, when they make these decisions, it is not, a decision that is made lightly, and it's not up to me to ask why. That's not my place. So I'm sure they have a reason why they shipped Gwen to 616. I'm sure it's a very valid one. I would love for them to go back to 65 at some point and finish those stories. But if they don't, at least I got to play in that sandbox and I got to add my little stamp to that world, which is more than I ever would have imagined.
So in that case, I don't know if she's listening to this, but any advice for Stephanie Phillips?
I don't think I need to. I think she could give me advice, honestly. Like, she is so good at what she does. I think she doesn't need any advice from me. I think she's fantastic.
Like, don't blow up Earth 65.
Please don't blow. I mean, I don't know if that's advice. That'd be like a very specific favor and request. Like, please don't destroy Earth 65 because I'd really like to come back to it.
Well, because she actually did have a short story in last week's Web of Spider-Man #1.
I haven't had a chance to read it yet. I've been really, really busy. Don't tell me she blew up Earth 65.
No, I also have not read it, so.
Okay. I'll be really sad, but I will accept it. But hopefully that's not what happened.
I'll just say it. No.
Okay. Okay. Thank God. All right.
Okay.
That's all that matters.
Thank you both ever so much for your time, both in coming on for this podcast recording and also just for your work on this book. I mean, cause clearly, like, a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of thought has gone into, you know, making even, you know, 4 or 5 issues of a comic book happen. It's every page clearly is got a lot of time that gets put into it, and we really appreciate that, and the research especially, and you know, it does mean a lot to us as fans.
Oh, appreciate it. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to listen to you guys, and clearly the passion that you have for the characters, that's what keeps them alive, and that's what keeps Gwen coming back. So thank you guys, because without that, we wouldn't have had the opportunity to work on the character.
Yes. And, well, I was going to say that actually in the form, I was thinking about this diagram of the philosophy of togetherness. The reader is central to the development of the stories. Even though you cannot like intervene in the decisions, you are waiting for the book and supporting all the chain of work by buying the book, by talking about it, by celebrating the characters' stories. So yeah, thanks to you as well.
A tradition we usually like to do when interviewing creators is ask a series of rapid fire questions, which is, you know, you just say the first thing that comes to your mind.
Okay.
So like, what do you prefer eating, corn dogs or hot dogs?
Corn dogs.
I'm vegetarian, but yeah, sometimes I eat sausages of soy.
Pax, next question.
I'm asking the second one, aren't I? Sorry, oh my goodness, sorry. They are Spider-Gwen related questions. Chuck Taylors or ballet flats?
Let's say that one more time.
Sorry, Chuck Taylors or ballet flats?
Chuck Taylors.
Yeah, for sure. Chuck Taylors as well.
Even though I pretty much know the answer to this, but let's just say it for the people at home. Who's Gwen's arch nemesis in your opinion?
Herself.
Melissa?
Oh, Jesus, I don't know. I feel like she has so many. Oh God, I think Enid is probably has the right answer. It's probably herself.
I think at NYCC you mentioned MJ.
And MJ, though I think they figured things out, so I think they're okay. But if Carnage comes back, that might change.
Which one of Gwen's powers would you like to have?
The spider sense, because I'm a big klutz.
I would say her innocence.
This is, look, philosophical answers. They're really good, Enid. I'm really making me pause for thought on some of these.
Favorite adaptation of Ghost Spider?
You mean like media?
In the media.
I mean, Into the Spider-Verse is pretty amazing. It's hard to top that one, in my opinion.
Yeah, I have, for example, two toys, two figures that I love. So I would really love to have the whole Mary Jane's to go along my Spider-Man figures. So, yeah.
Nice. So we've segmented the next two questions into comics that you've specifically worked on respectively. So for Melissa, who would win in a fight, Gwen or Maya Lopez / Echo?
Oh, shit. God. It's so hard. They're so strong, both of them. It depends on which version of Maya Lopez.
The comic version.
No, but I mean, like, is she the Phoenix or is she not?
Oh, just regular Maya Lopez. Just Echo.
Oh, God. I mean, I don't want anybody to come after me, but I feel like I would give the edge to Echo, not because she's stronger, but because I don't say she's smarter either, but she's hardcore.
Astute and strong.
Yeah. And she can see, like, she can mimic everybody's powers, like, just by looking at them. So it's like, it would take a lot for Gwen to be able Gwen's very inventive and clever. I don't know. I'm stuck. This is really hard for me.
Like, I thought they would come to a stalemate.
I feel like that would be the natural conclusion, because at the end of the day, they would very quickly realize they're not, like, unless, like, Gwen, you know, Echo thinks Gwen killed her dad, I don't think they're going to go very far.
For Enid specifically, now, who would win in a fight, Gwen or Kate Bishop?
I'd love to see them fight together, but I love them even more. That if she have that if she become or eventually have a common cause to fight alongside each other instead of between, to have a common thing to fight for, that would be lovely, isn't it?
It's true.
Okay, but if you had to pick one of the two to win,
why? they're both lovely, so I would really love to see them fight alongside. It will be amazing. So I'm looking forward to draw perhaps some young Avengers, maybe with Melissa. That would be amazing, right?
Yeah, that would be amazing. I would love to work with Enid again.
Yes.
It would be fantastic.
It's a really good team. Which spider person should Gwen hang out with more often?
And she's going to get a lot more time to do so in 616.
I really want her to hang out with Spider-Boy.
I feel like what's going on with Gwen right now, it's really funny how, like, the last thing she needs is a 10-year-old boy by her side.
But that's what makes the best story.
Recently, I heard that Bailey teamed up with Jessica Drew.
Yeah.
I'm yet to read Spider-Boy comics.
It's weird and fun. Like, Dan Slott's, it's clearly having the best time of his life.
Yeah, but I could see that, like, in the past, maybe Gwen did have a team up with Bailey before he got erased. But yeah, indeed, which spider person should Gwen hang out with more often?
Well, I don't know if Miles Morales, is it from here? Is he from Earth 65?
No.
She could hang out with him. She could hang out with him.
You'll have to give me choices to pick from, because I really don't know.
they could meet up. They could meet up.
Yeah, that'll be nice. I really love to see them together. there's much to finish in their story, right?
As long as they're not dating, because Miles is already with someone.
Yeah, I don't think that'll be, but maybe a friendship story, right?
Mm, yeah. All right. That wraps up our rapid fire questions, which, that was...
How about you guys? If you could answer in a short manner, what's the one thing you love most of the Spider-Man universe? The one thing you really love?
Her rogues gallery.
No, I really like her anti-authoritarian streak. Yeah. And then the fact that her dad is also like a former cop, that there's a lot to unpack there. I think that whole dynamic between her and like the police or the prison system or the government or whatever CEO she's bumped into. I love that, you know. I think Spider-Man stories have always kind of had that, but like Spider-Gwen stories really leaned into it, and that's what's always kind of pulled me into the sort of the bigger stuff. It's always very interesting.
And with her rogues gallery, it's because, you know, it's these completely different takes of these characters from 616. Matt Murdock, instead of being Daredevil, he's the Kingpin. You got Cindy Moon, who is like, I feel like calling her a terrorist is kind of overselling it, but she's pretty much a terrorist on Earth 65. And then, yeah, you've got MJ, who's Carnage, and Peter Parker, the Lizard.
Yeah.
All right. Should we begin wrapping up the show then here, yeah?
Yeah, before we let you guys go, is there anything you wanted to plug, some current and upcoming projects, where the humans can find you on social media, any upcoming conventions you're attending?
Right now I have three different projects in comics world that I can talk about. One is the Nacelleverse for Oni Press. Essentially, the guy that made The Toys That Made Us bought a bunch of toy properties from like the 50s, the 70s, 80s, and 90s, including Biker Mice from Mars and RoboForce. Yeah, and I get to write comics that put them all in the same universe. So that came out last week, issue 0, 40-page one shot. So please feel free to check it out. It's been a lot of fun. I also do the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, the ongoing series for Boom Studios. It is we're in the middle of an anniversary event called The Darkest Hour, and it's just released 118 today, and my creator owned for Image is called The Dead Lucky, and we just did the last issue 12, that also came out today. So definitely please check it out. It's a superhero series in the Massiverse, which is kind of like a superhero cinematic universe for Image, and Dead Lucky is about a PTSD ridden woman who loses her squad in accident in Jordan, comes home to her city in San Francisco, and discovers it's been privatized. And rather than deal with her PTSD, she uses these electrical spirits that she has haunting her to inhabit a bunch of robots and fight back. So a lot of fun.
Very cool.
Yeah. Also, out today. So check those out. And you can always find me on Twitter or Instagram at Misty_Flores.
Nice.
Anid?
Oh, yeah, I will be attending C2E2 in Chicago for the first time, the 26th up to the 28th of April. And then I will be at Baltimore Comic Con in September. And as for comic books, I'm doing a one-shot with Jubilee. She's fighting vampires, so it'll be awesome. And I have other things in the pipeline, but I cannot talk about them. So thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me, because as I said, it's been a privilege to work with Melissa, and it's lovely to see her at least digitally. So yeah,
it's so nice to see you.
I love to get to see you guys maybe at a convention, and maybe we can go for ice cream or some drinks. All right.
Oh, that would be really nice.
Well, if you come back to Toronto this year,
I will.
Oh, you are.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're any of you going to San Diego?
I usually am Comic-Con. Comic-Con's usually where I am, at San Diego. And then I'm going to be at WonderCon this weekend.
I'll actually be there on the first 2 days of San Diego.
Cool.
Look at that.
I'm usually there the whole week.
Like, I would have gone the whole weekend, but Saturday sold out first, so.
Oh, yeah, I'm lucky. I have a professional badge.
Gosh, I feel like I'm missing out. Very cool.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, no, it's been really nice. I'm ever so far away from North America. I all these conventions, they're one day. Is that the show then?
Pretty much.
Do we have an outro for the interview episodes, Abigail? Like, I can't remember. I'm half asleep here.
I don't remember either. So let's just all say bye to the humans.
I'm running on fumes.
All right. Great.
All right. Bye, humans.
Bye.
Bye.
See ya.